oral argument calendar.
Case number A220536, Pelosi versus Christensen.
The court has accepted appellant's brief and has denied the request by respondent to file a untimely brief. With that said, we will make a decision on the merits of the entire case. The rules of appellate procedure are a little bit different because we only have one person arguing. You'll have 15 minutes for presentation of your case in chief in support of your brief. When you're ready to proceed, please indicate who you are and which party you're speaking on behalf of. And with that said, let's go ahead.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Kuhl, and I represent the appellant, Ryan Christensen. We're here today because the procedure that the trial court used to substantially modify custody and primary residence contradicts clearly established law under both the Nice-Peterson case and Crawley versus Meyer. The Minnesota Supreme Court in Nice-Peterson states that the statute 518.185 requires the trial court to deny a motion for modification of a custody order unless the accompanying affidavits set forth a prima facie case of endangerment. And it reached that conclusion by construing the statute in conformity with the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act. And that uniform statute is even more explicit in stating the court shall deny the motion. And so that's the language that the Minnesota Supreme Court in Nice-Peterson effectively read into the statute. And here the trial court expressly found that father failed to meet that prima facie showing, but instead of denying the motion as Nice-Peterson requires, it set the matter for an evidentiary hearing. And then after that evidentiary hearing, which was purportedly to decide parenting time, issued a schedule which amounts to a de facto modification of custody. So that is the error. The procedure outlined in Nice-Peterson is important.
Oh, back up a little bit. You say a de facto modification, but in this case, I meant to bring my district court file in, but I did not. I understand that the trial court specifically labeled it as a continuation of joint legal and joint physical custody, did it not?
Correct, but it changed the parenting time schedule from mother had 71% of the time to 32%, I believe it was. Which, under the Minnesota Supreme Court case law, specifically MJH and cases that follow that standard, when you change parenting time schedules that dramatically, it amounts to a de facto modification of custody.
And I get that. I understand that, and I understand the cases that support that. But in a way, aren't we splitting hairs over that? Because if a parent, for instance, has summertime visitation, you may have all glorious days of hopefully sunshine as compared to somebody that has custody during a school year when the kids are in school. And ultimately, wouldn't it come to the court to say, look, this is just the deal, the stipulation that they would have shared custody because it was a stipulation that's in place, but we have life and reality going on. We have sports, we have this, we have that. So we're not going to slice and dice. We're just going to continue with a joint categorization of custody. You're both good parents. Both need to be involved in the children's life. What difference does it make? And I'm probably quarreling with Supreme Court, but to me it seems that we're splitting hairs over that when we're not actually saying let's put our timer on and see how much time this kid is with this particular parent.
Well, I think it does make a big difference, respectfully. I think the amount of time with a parent is absolutely important, whether that's getting them ready for bed on a school night or whether that's playing in the sunshine in the summer. The amount of time does matter and is important to parents.
But isn't that, I mean, obviously what I'm talking about is quality time versus the amount of time. So at what point do we use some common sense and look at that?
Well,
I mean, mom actually, in the long run, could actually be seeing and engaging with the children more than dad. I mean, conceivably, not in this case, but couldn't that also happen?
Under this case, no. I mean, she has 31% of the time under the court's schedule. So even if that's a high-quality time, there's just not an amount that's going to be sufficient to create, you know, a real close parent-child relationship. That's a low percentage of time. And so, again, I think the case law is clear that the endangerment standard
still... I'm just going to keep picking on you because there's nobody coming after you. So at what point do we decide when the numbers all of a sudden reach that optimal, this is de facto, and if it would have been an extra 5 hours, it wouldn't have been de facto? I mean, how do we know? What are we gauging that on?
There's a lot of case law on that, and there are edge cases on that. Respectfully, this is not an edge case. That when you compare it to the other changes that have been deemed to be substantial changes to the parenting time schedule, much lower changes have been deemed substantial and have amounted to a de facto modification than the amount of a change that we're talking about here. This is basically a 180 from having 70% of the time to about 30% of the time.
So help me out here, and I know the primary residence designation was changed. So what legal significance does that have going forward? What does that mean?
Well, the primary...
Because it's not really in the statute, is it? I don't know. But help me out here.
It's significant because to change primary residence, you need to meet the endangerment standard. And so if primary residence is now with father going forward, mother would have to meet the endangerment standard to, you know, change that again. And so that does affect the analysis here quite a bit.
Counsel, as long as you've raised the endangerment standard, putting aside the procedural issues for a minute, the court found that the appellant's multiple hospitalizations, serious medical issues, ventral time and rehab, suggested that her alcoholism was not just severe but life-threatening. 8 times in 2 years for alcohol-induced acute pancreatitis, alcohol abuse, alcoholic hepatitis, anemia, diabetes, attended inpatient substance abuse treatment. And then all those times she either gave the children to her parents, grandparents, or to a neighbor. Do you want to address the endangerment finding?
Sure. All of the times that she was, first of all, she has not been hospitalized since she became sober, and so it's not a present concern. And in addition, all of the times that she was hospitalized, she took measures to make sure that these children were not in danger. She left them with her parents or with a responsible neighbor, and father admitted they were not endangered in the grandparents' care. So she's doing all of the right things to make sure that while she has a medical condition, it's not affecting the children, it's not affecting their physical safety or their emotional development. They're still getting the care that they need while she gets the care that she needs.
Well, how do we know that? I mean, the neighbor? I mean, why is that the right thing to do? Drop the kids with a neighbor and then go to the hospital 8 times?
I believe the neighbor was once, if I recall the record correctly, and that was because she had to go, you know, emergently. But the record shows that most of the time it was with the grandparents and that the grandparents were in contact with the father. He had a right of first refusal. He could have come and taken the children and provided care for them as well, and he chose not to do so. He chose to leave them with the grandparents, presumably because, as he admitted...
I thought that the dad wasn't alerted. Am I incorrect in that?
So the record shows that he complained that the mother did not inform him that she was in the hospital, which was technically correct because she was in the hospital, but her father, the grandparent, did inform the father. So he was aware, and there's text messages in the record from the grandfather to the father about
that. The age of the children would also affect endangerment. Would you agree with that? I mean, now as we're sitting here today, and of course this is after the fact, but the kids are 9, the twins, I should say twins, they're going to be 10, but they're not 10 yet. Should that have been a relevant factor as far as the district court saying there was no endangerment?
I'm not sure which way it plays. I think in part the age is interesting because, you know, if this was a case where, you know, she was drinking so frequently during her parenting time that she had some sort of altered behaviors or was behaving inappropriately, you would expect a 10-year-old children or 9-year-old children to be able to report that and say, during this parenting time, some really weird stuff is happening. And there's no evidence that they did in this record.
We commend mother on her sobriety, and we think that's obviously a very positive thing as far as parenting as well as her own health. Will you address your due process argument? I mean, there was a 2-day evidentiary hearing, so I'm kind of not following your argument about failure to have due process.
So that
what
goes.
What process was not given to her? What is it?
She was not alerted that this was going to be an evidentiary hearing about custody. And then she was told multiple times, the scheduling order said that the issues to be decided were parenting time. And she asked the trial court about that, and the trial court specifically said, this is not going on for a custody trial. So she prepared for an evidentiary hearing on parenting time. But then after the trial, after the evidentiary hearing, the court issues an order which amounts to a de facto modification of custody. And that's important because she was entitled to assume that the trial court would follow its order, which said it was considering parenting time only. She was entitled to assume that it would follow Crawley versus Meyer, which means it was considering a change to the parenting time schedule in the judgment and decree, not a change to the temporary schedule. And so when the trial court then subsequently modifies custody, when it did not tell her it was going to consider custody, that is the denial of due process. That's the failure to provide notice.
So if we assume there was a procedural error, your client still has to show that she was prejudiced. And I didn't see any place in the brief, and I'm interested whether in front of the district court it was what additional evidence would have been presented if proper notice had been given that, yes, I don't know if there's endangerment, but I'm going to hold this evidentiary hearing, so it could be custody or it could just be parenting time.
So a couple of responses to that. One is that we don't know what she would have presented because she was never given the opportunity to make that decision. So we don't know if she would have presented different
evidence. But it's on you to show prejudice. Without prejudice, you're not entitled to a reversal. So we can't just imagine that there might have been. I mean, that's just not the law. And I did read in the transcript that there was a fair amount of questioning by mom's counsel on the question of endangerment. I mean, literally endangerment. That, you know, how many school days were missed? Was there any evidence that mom was under the influence when she was with the kids or at other activities or appointments related to the children? So I guess I'm wondering how, the court did say parenting time, and then the court switched gears based on the additional evidence presented. But I'm wondering where the prejudice is and how we can reverse on an imaginary, that there might be prejudice, that we don't know, that this is... So help me out here.
So if you go back to Nice Peterson, the point of having the prima facie case, the endangerment requirement, is to prevent having to go through these evidentiary hearings, which are costly and expensive and time-consuming. It's to prevent parents from repeatedly bringing these types of motions and forcing the other parent to go through these types of hearings when there's been no prima facie case. So that's why the motion should have been simply denied when he failed to make that prima facie case.
But isn't it also fair for us to look at the fact that the husband didn't have medical records? The husband was not fully aware of the extent of mom's medical issues. And mom, in fact, I think, has a general duty to bring forward information aside from discovery. But once those medical records were provided, then we've got a different case than when the court initially denied said that endangerment, a prima facie case of endangerment had not been made out. And what do we do with that? Because as time evolves, as more information comes out, I mean, I think that's what the court was dealing with here.
So it would have been very simple. All that the court needed to do was deny it when it found no prima facie case of endangerment. When more medical records come out, what have you, the father could have simply brought another motion at that point, and then if the trial court found endangerment, we wouldn't be here. That would be a completely different scenario. Or if during the evidentiary hearing, the trial court said, gee, some of this that's coming out seems like it might rise to the level of endangerment, pause the hearing, give us notice that you're then considering custody. That would have been appropriate if it had then.
Father can still do that. He can still produce records or assertions that mother during her reduced parenting time is still a danger to the children and ask for sole legal and physical custody. That hasn't happened, but he still has that option, correct?
Right. So if this court were to reverse, finding that Nice-Peterson and Crawley versus Meyer were not met, remands to the trial court, then if father wants to bring a motion where he properly submits evidence that meets a prima facie case of endangerment and it's set for a hearing where there's notice that custody will be considered, that would be different, and that would not result in the issues that we have in this case. So for all of those reasons, we would respectfully request the court reverse.
Thank you. Thank you for your briefing. Thank you for your argument. The matter was well argued. And that does conclude our oral argument calendar today. We are in recess. Thank you.